The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
David Detmer is a professor of philosophy at Purdue University Northwest. He is the author of Freedom as Value, Challenging Postmodernism, Philosophy and the Politics of Truth, and the Zero Books title, Xenophobia, about Howard Zinn. It's Sunday, August 25th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available for everyone. Our patrons get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. Patrons also receive access to our new video series called The History of Communism, and the next one should be coming out this week. And they also get access to the Capital Reading Group and the Zero Books Club members who pay $15 a month get access to a new Zero Books title every month and are invited to an online discussion group. So if you like Zero Books, become a patron. The music you're listening to right now is a jazzy number from Storyblocks, a stock music and stock footage service. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Professor David Detmer and myself discuss Howard Zinn and xenophobia. Professor David Detmer is a professor of philosophy at Purdue University Northwest. He is the author of several books, including Challenging Postmodernism, Sartre Explained, and Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics and Scholarship, which we published at Zero Books last year. Professor David Detmer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm pleased to have you on. Of course, I'm a fan of the late Howard Zinn. In the 90s, when I was younger, of course, everyone was younger in the 90s, I would say that Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky were two of the two people who kind of introduced me to left thought, very influential American leftists. So I'm wanting to start by asking you sort of a fanish question, which is what was your relationship like with Howard Zinn? He was your teacher at Boston University, is that right?
That's right. I was an undergraduate at Boston University in the late 70s. I graduated from there in 1980, and Howard Zinn was a professor there. I took two classes from him. I always like to say I don't want to exaggerate how well I knew him, because we were in different fields. I was philosophy. He, of course, was history. But I did take two courses from him, and I thought he was just a wonderful teacher. He was always very clear in his lectures, jam-packed with information. He had a great sense of humor. Anyone who's ever seen him give a lecture knows that he had a wonderful sense of humor. He had a way of presenting his ideas forcefully, but in a very friendly way, so that even conservative students tended to like him and respect him. Also, he encouraged his students to come to his office hours to discuss ideas. So when he would assign a paper, he would say, you know, he'd write comments on it, but he'd also say, you know, come to my office and discuss it. So there was always quite a long line. And what I found is he took a real interest in his students. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, how the first time I went to his office, when we were done talking about my paper, he noticed I had a copy of Plato's Republic. And he said, oh, are you a philosophy major? And I said, yes. And we proceeded to have a really nice conversation about Plato. And I found that to be very typical of him. He was not just interested in history and politics. He was interested in philosophy and the arts and just lots and lots of subjects, and was very well read and was just a wonderful person to talk to.
Did Howard Zinn influence your politics when you were his student?
I suppose he did. I mean, I was fairly left-wing already, but I certainly learned lots of details from him. I learned lots of ideas from him that I hadn't known. So I'm sure he did have an influence. And also, Chomsky, you mentioned Noam Chomsky. He was, of course, at MIT, and I made a point of hearing him lecture several times as well, and I read his books also. So both of them had a big influence on me as well.
How did you come to write Xenophobia? When did you decide to write the book, and what brought you to the decision to tackle, I guess, the Daniels Zinn controversy, but also just to defend Howard Zinn's reputation?
Well, that's right. What got it started, it wasn't initially a book project. It just kind of grew organically. What happened was, in 2013, right after Mitch Daniels had been named as the new president of Purdue University, and so just to make clear my relationship to him, I'm at a branch campus of Purdue. I'm at Purdue University Northwest, which is in essentially a suburb of Chicago in the northwest corner of the state. He is the president of the whole Purdue system, but he mainly deals with the main campus in West Lafayette. But in any case, he's sort of officially my boss. He's the president of my university. And right after, very shortly after he was named president, there was an item in the news that got a fair amount of play for a little while. An Associated Press reporter, Tom LaBianco, had done a Freedom of Information Act request to get access to Mitch Daniels' emails when he had been governor of Indiana. And he found an item where one day, in fact, it was right after Howard Zinn died, that was the occasion, Daniels sent off an email where he said, I forget his exact words, but he said something to the effect of, this horrible anti-American has finally passed away. Let's make sure that his horrible book, his terrible anti-American book, A People's History of the United States, is never taught for credit in the state of Indiana. And so that, of course, interested me, since I was a former student of Howard Zinn's, and now it's the president of my university in his actions as the governor of my state. So I kind of felt I personally should look into this a bit. And the first thing I was interested in was just the actual claims that Daniels made about what he had done. The press was rather negative, although Daniels generally gets a very good press, I think undeservedly so, but he does tend to get a very positive press. But the press tended to think it's not appropriate for a governor to be meddling in decisions about what textbooks are used in school, and it smacks of censorship and so on. And so when this was made public, in defending himself, he made a number of statements that I investigated, and I found that none of them were true. So I'll just give you one example. He said, I was only talking about K-12 education. I certainly respect academic freedom at the university, so I certainly wasn't talking about that. But when you look at the text of the email exchange, it will not support that interpretation, because he had said, obituaries say that Zinn's book is the textbook of choice in high schools and universities around the country. Let's make sure it's not being used in our state. And then when his subordinates got back to him, they said, hey, we found it's being used in a course at Indiana University. And so Daniel said, well, we can't have that. Let's ban it. Let's disqualify it. It's propaganda. So he was telling falsehoods about what he was doing. He was trying to meddle in university education, not just K-12. So then the next thing I noticed, I realize this is a long-winded answer. I'm almost to the end of it. He was a bit embarrassed by the bad publicity. So he called attention to the fact that several respected academics, including some prominent historians, had also said very negative things about Zen. It said, oh, you know, he's not much of a scholar, or, you know, I don't take him seriously, that sort of thing. And Daniels also said, Daniels provided, I forget, 3, 4, or 5 quotes like that. And then he also said, if anybody wants more, just contact me and I'll give you more. So I sent him an email and his secretary got back to me and they gave me a longer list. So I then started reading the works of these critics. And what I found over and over again is that they made just appalling, demonstrable errors. They would say, Zen says X, and I'd look up the relevant passage, and that's not what Zen said. Or they'd say, Zen never acknowledges Y, and then I'd find 20 passages where he acknowledges Y, and so on and so forth. And so I started writing up some little essays about these people, and it sort of mushroomed into a book. So basically what the book does, I've got a chapter on the Daniel Zen controversy. I've got a middle chapter where I talk a little bit about Howard Zinn and his career. And also I try to, this is sort of the most philosophical part of the book, I try to explain a little bit his philosophy of history, what he was doing in a book like A People's History. But the longest chapter is the last chapter, where I discuss 25 of Zinn's harshest critics, and I try to demonstrate that they, the language I use in the book, this is very harsh, but I essentially say it doesn't rise to the level of a C-minus effort in a freshman class. That's how bad it is. And I'm talking about historians at Stanford, Princeton, Harvard, people who have won Pulitzer Prizes. I frankly found it scandalous. And so that's why I called the book, it's kind of a bad pun, but that's why I called the book Xenophobia. It's as if we need a psychiatric explanation. Not that I provide one in the book. I try to confine myself to what I can prove. But anyway, so that's how it all started.
Yeah. So Governor Daniels, or President Daniels now, how would you describe his politics?
Well, he's pretty conservative. He's not like Trump. He's not a crazy ranting maniac like Trump, but he's very conservative, and especially, I think, well, maybe I shouldn't say especially, but someone like Zinn, I think his take on it is just that, as he said, he finds Zinn to be anti-American. He's the kind of conservative who sees any kind of strong, principled criticism of the United States as some kind of horrible moral affront. So I guess that's how I would summarize it.
Yeah, okay. And he was a Republican.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
He served in, he was the budget director for George W. Bush.
Okay. So I just wanted to make that, I should know that, I suppose, but I wanted to make that clear that he was a Republican conservative going after Zinn for being un-American.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And one of the things that they raised against Howard Zinn was that he admitted to being biased, that Howard Zinn himself would admit to being biased. And I wanted to ask you, what did Howard Zinn mean when he would say things like, you can never be neutral on a moving train?
Right. Yes. So before I answer that, just one sort of editorial comment, and then I'll answer your question. The editorial comment I want to make is that this is another thing that I found frustrating about so many of these scholars who have written about Zinn. Not only did they make all kinds of demonstrable factual errors, as I mentioned, but several of them would go after him for saying things like, you know, admitting that he has a bias, and then not discussing what he meant by that. If someone comes out and says something like, I'm biased, before you just go after that, you have to look into what it means, because Zinn would always clarify what he meant by that. And you brought up his phrase, you can't be neutral on a moving train. And that's really a good way to get into it. So part of the idea, he takes the claim that it's really, in most cases, it's not possible to be neutral. there are certain highly specific, well-defined cases where you could be neutral. In the book, I give the example, let's say you're a line judge at a tennis match. So there you've got just one simple, clear issue. Was the ball inside the line or outside the line? So there's a sense in which it's good to be neutral, to sort of not care who wins or loses. You're just going to, you know, call it accurately and so on. But when you get into questions of history and politics and so on, things have already happened. Things are already one way rather than another. So if you are neutral, you're implicitly supporting the status quo. I just read this recently, something about how, you know, if an elephant is standing on the foot of a mouse and you say you're neutral, the mouse won't be happy about it. You know, it's that kind of thing. And also sort of related to this, I'm going to get back to the bias thing in a minute, but related to this is the idea that unlike the tennis example, when you're doing history, there's this important question of selection. No one wants to read a history book that tries to relate every fact, no matter how trivial, no matter how uninteresting. So you have to select what you consider to be interesting or important or relevant or whatever. And values are going to come into play for that. And so this is what Zinn was talking about when he's talking about bias. So in the first chapter of his book, A People's History, he uses a really excellent example to show this. He cites the Harvard historian Samuel Eliot Morison, who was evidently the premier historian of Columbus, wrote a multi-volume biography of him. And on the question of Zinn's involvement in killing Indians and being involved in the slave trade.
Not Zinn's involvement.
Yeah, that's a bad – boy, that was a bad mistake on my part. Yes, you're right. Thank you for catching that. Columbus's involvement. Zinn points out that Morison does not completely duck the issue, nor does he sugarcoat it. He has a sentence where he says something like, I'm quoting from memory, but I think this is pretty close to it. Columbus's cruel practice toward the Indians amounted to genocide. So Morison actually used the word genocide, as harsh a word as you can use. But Zinn makes the point that Morison, that's just one paragraph in a 500-plus page book. It's not at all what he emphasizes. He emphasizes Columbus's exploits as an explorer and a navigator and so on. And so now finally back to your question about bias, one meaning of the word bias, let me start again. Oftentimes when we use the word bias, probably usually we mean a kind of irrational prejudice or a kind of unfair prejudice. But a more neutral meaning of the word bias is just a leaning, being inclined in one way rather than another, such that a bias in favor of something good can be a good thing, just as a bias in favor of something bad can be a bad thing. And so Zinn's point is, given the necessity of selection when you're involved in any kind of narrative writing, as is the case with historical scholarship, you need to decide what's important, what should be emphasized, what should be de-emphasized, what should be included, what is it okay to leave out. And so he says, I have a bias in that direction. And one way of looking at it is, this is again Zinn, he would be saying, I think genocide is more significant than being one of the first Europeans in a certain part of the world, things of that nature. So it's not that he's trying to justify some kind of irrational prejudice. It's rather he's trying to acknowledge that it's necessary to have preferences and inclinations in matters of values, which in turn inform issues of selection in narrative writing and historical scholarship.
Right. So one thing that comes to me now is the way in which having a countervailing bias is more obvious than if you are biased in the favor of, say, the consensus. I have been accused of being biased against astrology. And I'll say, oh, I'm not biased. I mean, I haven't looked into it, but it just isn't worthy of my consideration. And I think I'm justified in that, right? But some people who would be just sort of inclined to be pro-American, who look to America as being a beacon on the hill to be the great world leader for freedom and democracy, would be biased towards America and would kind of consider their bias to be similar to my bias against astrology. It's just like the natural position for a reasonable person to take. So Zinn had to overcome the bias of the mainstream in his work.
Yeah. Now, I'm intrigued by your analogy, so I'm thinking about that right now. And the first thing that occurs to me, I would assume the basis for your bias against astrology, and I share the same bias, by the way, and I assume it would be because you have enough background knowledge about how the world works that you can see how implausible the whole idea of astrology is. I mean, this idea that the position of the planets would have this extraordinary effect on one's personality, there doesn't seem to be any scientific basis for it. People will talk about gravity, but the gravitational influence of the weight of the attending physician when you're born, that variation is greater than what you're going to get from the planets because they're so far away, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a kind of evidentiary basis for considering it ridiculous that is strong enough as to make it justified that maybe you don't have to look into all of the particulars. So it seems to me there the bias is evidentiary, whereas when it comes to this kind of patriotic bias, there, it's not based on anything evidentiary. It's based on, it's the same reason why people root for their home team and root for the, you know, it's sort of like, you know, America is us and we love us, not them. You know, sort of the us versus them psychology as opposed to something evidentiary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But let me push back on that a little bit. So what I was thinking of was more of my interpretive framework rather than my the evidence I might have examined. Because, to be honest, I haven't examined the evidence for astrology, right? And I don't even want to start examining the evidence for astrology because I have an interpretive framework that precludes it. I have I tend to be a materialist. More and more I'm a materialist, you know. I tend to look for those kinds of explanations for things where you're looking for a mechanism in the material world, an objective reality. Now, you could be someone who comes from a very different tradition. Say you're some sort of radical idealist who wouldn't be looking for those kinds of things and might be able to have totally different standards of evidence and create evidence. So then before I could even look at your evidence, I'd have to test your interpretive framework, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. And getting back to what you said before about Zinn having to overcome that, I think that's a really good point. Because as I think I might have mentioned earlier, maybe I'll spell it out more fully now, in the book, I say almost nothing on the question of why all these critics get Zinn wrong. And one reason why is I can't prove that. That would be speculation. And I wanted to just have things I could really nail down and really prove that they got it wrong. Why they got it wrong, that's speculation. But getting back to your question, it does seem that these people just can't understand what Zinn is saying. They just don't get it, even though he's a very clear writer. And now these are highly intelligent, highly educated people. How do we explain the fact that they don't get it? Now I think what you're saying comes into play. It's the framework they have. What he's saying is so alien to the framework they have that it just doesn't make any sense to them.
So can we talk about the majority of the people who you looked at in your book? Because what I noticed about them was, for the most part, they were conservatives. I mean, they weren't even Democrats to a large extent. I think I saw David Horowitz on the list. There was an exception or two. But would you say that's mostly true, that these were conservative historians?
I don't know. I'd have to go through and look at it, because on the list there is Michael Kazin,
who I want to talk about. Yeah.
Sure. So we can come to him. So he's someone who's usually thought of as being on the left. There's Sam Weinberg. I don't know a whole lot about his politics, but from looking at his stuff, my guess is he's a liberal and a Democrat rather than a Republican, would be my guess. I don't know that for sure. I suppose you're probably right that a lot of them are right wingers. But on the other hand, I think there's a special kind of hatred that some people who are a little left of center have towards someone who is further to the left. And I think that plays into this somewhat as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that's really interesting and good. So I did want to talk about specifically Michael Kazin, because to me he stuck out as a anomaly on your list. But let me just back up and say, when I have talked to historians who have written for our imprint, the two historians, and maybe this won't go into the podcast, the two historians, I'm not going to name them, who I talked to about Zen briefly, neither of them had anything good to say about him. One of them I would say was kind of an anomaly for our imprint, because he's a sort of centrist liberal. The other, though, is a very strong social democratic leftist with a history of writing about Marx. So what I was trying to figure out is what is the consensus about Zen in amongst historians? Is there one? And then what would explain their approach to Howard Zinn? I mean, they weren't going to side with Daniels in this controversy. Neither would have done that. But they both were rather critical of Zinn. So I'm trying to figure out what their interpretive framework is, or what their you know, presuppositions are that make Zinn difficult for them.
Well, now, see, again, I want to preface my answer by saying, again, this is under the heading of speculation. And I keep wanting them, you know, in my book, it's all nailed down with page numbers and everything. So I'll engage in a bit of speculation.
Yeah, we're going off the topic of your book in a way, because people should go and buy your book and read it. But I'm just, this is my, like, kind of inside baseball on the left. What can
sure,
we say
no.
is going on?
I'm happy to talk about it. I just wanted to make clear what I claim to know and be able to prove versus what I'm speculating about. That's the only reason I'm saying that. So I can think of a couple of things I might say, because I have thought a lot about this. How do these people make these incredible blunders that they make when they talk about Zen? And so for people who are left of center, I can think of a couple of things maybe. So one is, I do mention in the book, I draw a distinction between political conservatism and professional conservatism. So in any academic discipline, people tend to kind of absorb somewhat uncritically the norms of their teachers and sort of the norms of the profession. And so Zinn was certainly doing lots of things very, very differently than other historians have done. And so I've noticed many people, the way they want to criticize Zinn is they want to say things like, that's not history. They don't say it's bad history. They say, oh, that's not history at all. That's something else. And so I think that might be part of it. There's this, you know, he's not writing about what other people wrote about. He's not writing about things the way other people wrote about them. And so no matter what their politics are, it might be, well, that just looks wrong from a professional standpoint. That's one thing I'll say. A second thing is Zinn's book, as you know, has been spectacularly successful at finding an audience. Last figure I saw, it had sold more than 2.6 million copies, which is pretty much unprecedented for a book on American history. And popularizers always get a hard time from academics. There's sort of this idea, oh, if it's popular, it's got to be really soft and not rigorous, and so on. Perhaps jealousy is part of it. I mean, if we're going to engage in speculation like that. And also Zinn, I think you'll probably agree with me on this, was a very unpretentious person. You know, he wrote in very plain and clear prose. He didn't use a lot of technical academic jargon. And some people confuse that with a lack of sophistication. And that to me is a really striking thing. One thing I feel quite convinced of from having known him and from having read his books was that he was a very sophisticated thinker with a wide range of knowledge in many academic fields. And I think even some people who like Zinn think of him as something of a lightweight. And I suspect that's because he wrote not primarily for academics. I think he wrote primarily for a general audience. Even before People's History, he wrote a lot of things for The Nation and publications like that for a general audience. So I suspect that might be part of it as well. But again, I'll conclude as I began saying, all of that is speculation. I'm not really sure I understand the phenomenon.
Yeah. What would you say the worst criticisms of Zinn were? And, and were there a few themes that emerged as you read through these criticisms?
Let's see. How do I go at this?
Ones irritated you the most would be maybe fine.
Okay. So here would be one way of getting into it. I think almost all of these critics exaggerate whatever is going on to the point where they make ridiculous errors. So I'll give you maybe the clearest example. If you wanted to be accurate in talking about Zinn, you could say something like, well, his account is more critical of traditional American heroes like the American presidents than is the norm in historical scholarship. If you said that, that would be completely accurate. So what do these people do? So Sean Wilentz, a big mucky-muck professor of history at Princeton, on the occasion of Zinn's death, and in fact, I'm going to look at this to get it exactly right. On the occasion of Zinn's death, the LA Times did an article where they asked a number of historians what they thought of Zinn. And Wilentz said, and here I'm quoting, "Zinn had a very simplified view that everyone who was president was always a stinker and every left winger was always great. That can't be true. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. You wouldn't know that from Howard Zinn." So when I read that, I went to A People's History and opened up the chapter on the Civil War, and on the very first page, I found the following sentence. It was Abraham Lincoln who freed the slaves. So I think what happened to Wilentz is, he noticed that Zinn had critical things to say about lots of U.S. presidents, including ones that Wilentz admires. And in his mind, it turns into he doesn't recognize any good thing that any president ever did. And then he's so arrogant, he issues this palpably false claim on the occasion of Zinn's death, mind you, for publication, and doesn't even bother to check whether it's true, which you could easily do if you just consulted the index, So I found that kind of thing happening over and over again. So here's another example. I guess because it would be accurate to say that Zinn is a leftist. That's certainly true. If somebody said that, I wouldn't quibble. But then you find people who want to turn that into, oh, he was a fan of the Soviet Union, or he was an apologist for the Soviet Union. So two of these critics did that. Oscar Handlin, Harvard Pulitzer Prize-winning Harvard historian, he wrote a review of A People's History for the journal The American Scholar, where he said that. He said, quote, not a word about the Soviet Union, of course. So, you know, the full quote was something to the effect of, you know, Zinn heaps lots of scorn on the U.S., not a word about the Soviet Union, of course. And then David Greenberg, a professor at Rutgers University. And by the way, going back to your earlier question about the political orientation, I think Greenberg's another one of these people who's probably sort of a liberal Democrat, left of center, but very much against leftists like Zinn in his politics. But anyway, so he wrote an article in the New Republic in which he said the following. I'm looking at the quote in front of me. Zinn, quote, relentlessly criticized American policy and seems to have stayed silent about the Soviet Union. Now, the first thing I noticed when I read that is, who would say something like that, seems to have stayed silent? You know, why wouldn't you check the record and see whether he stayed silent? And so so I didn't take much digging at all. You know, I got out some of Zinn's books and used the index. And I found a statement like the following. Here's an example of something Zinn had written. The Soviet Union has been brutal in its treatment of its own citizens, murdering peasants in large numbers during the process of collectivization, imprisoning, torturing, and executing those it considered dissidents. The term police state fits it very well. It goes on and on like this. And so in Xenophobia, I quote several passages from several works, including A People's History, in which he uses the following words to characterize the Soviet Union, quote, ruthless, oppressive, brutal, murderous, a dictatorship, a police state, an example of fascism, and he uses words like aggression, atrocities, monstrous tyranny. And here you've got David Greenberg, you know, writing an article in the New Republic saying he seems to have stayed silent about the Soviet Union. Again, I ask you, you know, would that fly for an essay by a freshman, you know, in a freshman class? You write something critical of someone and you give as your evidence something that's just easily disproven like that. It's just amazing.
Depends on the professor. I guess some professors are lazy, but probably not. I mean, but I was thinking exactly, why would the New Republic not have, you know, someone on hand to check on those things, when those kinds of claims? Although, as a publisher, I know that, you know, more and more it's a matter of budget.
Here's what I would say about that. One thing I make clear in the book is that I am only discussing critics who have a certain kind of harsh critique of Zinn, where they're saying he's horrible, he's not a scholar, he's not a historian, no one should ever teach his works, and so on. I'm not going after people who give the normal scholarly restrained kind of critique. You know, oh, look, I interpret such and such a historical event a little differently than you do based on this evidence. I'm not going after people like that. So I'm not at all trying to suggest that his works are, you know, not open to reasonable criticism. But there's this whole phenomenon of people making these outrageous criticisms. But in going through, I did find a very small number of criticisms that I thought were sound in these vituperative works. So, for example, several of the critics accuse Zinn of making a lot of factual errors. Oh, lots and lots of factual inaccuracies. Then I would look at the examples that they gave, and almost every time I found either that Zinn never said the thing that they accused him of saying, or, you know, he put some qualification on it that they overlooked, or, as I read the factual record, Zinn is right and the critics are wrong. But there were maybe two or three examples where I thought the critics were right. So the biggest one I can think of is Zinn in A People's History said that the death toll from the bombing of Dresden was over 100,000. And contemporary scholarship suggests the actual figure is probably closer to 20,000 to 25,000. But even there, I think there's an explanation for how Zen could have made a mistake like that. And that is, there was a period when it was a very orthodox view that the death count was over 100,000, and it's more recent scholarship that has put it at a lower figure. And that more recent scholarship did come out while Zen was still alive, and Zen did make several corrections in the people's history over the years, as people would point out things. So in the successive revisions, he did correct a few things like that, and he didn't correct that one. So my guess is he missed that one, he overlooked that one, nobody pointed it out to him, something like that. So at least it's sort of understandable how it could have happened. And so the very few errors, I think I only found like two or three, and they were all sort of like that. But I found probably, just off the top of my head, I'm guessing 30 or 40 alleged factual errors that are not. And it's just sort of amazing the lengths that people would go to try to pin a factual error on him. So, for example, there's a guy named Daniel Flynn. Now, he's not, I think, a distinguished scholar. I think he's just sort of a conservative writer who's written lots of books. But at one point, you know, he says, oh, Zen says that the crime rate went up when it really went down. And so I looked at the passages in question, and it turns out that Flynn completely misrepresented what time period Zen was talking about. And in his quotation, he even changed the tense in the verb that Zen used without indicating with any kind of, you know, brackets or anything like that, that he had done so. So it looks like a deliberate, you know, a deliberate distortion to try to make turn out that it was a factual error. And one point I make in the book, it's kind of a lawyerly point. But what a lot of these people do is they'll say, oh, Zen has committed a whole bunch of factual errors. In fact, Mitch Daniels says he misstates American history on every page. That's what Mitch Daniels says. But anyway, a lot of these people say, oh, he's got all of these factual errors. Here, let me give you three examples. And that's all they give. And then it's easy for me to debunk all three. And mind you, I'm not saying by debunk, I don't mean, oh, here's a way that you if you kind of squint a certain way and are generous in your interpretation, maybe Zen is okay. No, I mean, it's clear the critic is wrong and Zen is right, that kind of thing. So they'll say, here are these three examples. He commits all these errors. Here, I'll give you three. Then after I debunk all three, I make the kind of lawyerly point. Look, this person says there are dozens and dozens of errors. He got to choose which ones to present. They don't hold up. What does that tell you, you know?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So, okay, so the strongest objections were ones of when Zen had made an error regarding the facts, but those were vastly overstated. Yeah, and often embarrassingly so, because people would make mistakes themselves and when they're trying to refute Zen. And that's pretty typical. I want to talk about Michael Kazin now, if we can, for just a minute, because he was the most interesting critic to me, and it was probably because of my own interpretive frame or my own little obsessions, or maybe they're not little, but I'm not doing much about them. But so he said that the main thing that he leveled at Zen that I thought was of interest, not that it was a great criticism of Howard Zinn per se, but that it was really an important thing to raise, which was he said that Zinn left out how the American public had accommodated itself to the U.S. capitalist republic and considered it to be legitimate. And for me, this stood out like a sore thumb, or like it was a big red flag or some sort of, you know, neon, because this is the question from my framing that sort of set off the Frankfurt School, right? You know, like, why is it that the working class hasn't overturned capitalism? How is it that the working classes are accommodating themselves to their own exploitation? How is it that the ideas of Marx around the proletariat being a revolutionary class haven't come to fruition. And to me, that raising that objection to Zen is sort of a maybe an unfair objection, but it's also kind of a deep one. It's like saying you are presenting all the facts of the history of imperialism, of the injustice, of the contradictions, of the inhumanity of the U.S. capitalist republic, but also of capitalism itself. Say, and but what we both know is that the working class lived through this and accommodated itself to it. So how can presenting this history change our circumstance? Maybe that was an underlying. I don't think Kazin was saying that precisely, but that at all, maybe. But it's something that's sort of in the background.
Yeah, I'm looking because I do discuss this in my book, and so while you're talking, I looked up the relevant passage. So is I've been saying Kazin. Is it Kazin? Is that how it's pronounced?
I don't know. You know, you say it correctly. I always say every name incorrectly.
No, I was just going by the spelling. I don't know either. So neither one of us knows.
I was going by the spelling as well and pronouncing it incorrectly.
Whatever his name is, I've got
Kazin.
A quotation.
We'll say Kazin like raisin. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Kazin like raisin. I'm quoting him in my book where he said, quote, Zen makes no serious attempt to address the biggest question a leftist can ask about U.S. history. Why have most Americans accepted the legitimacy of the capitalist republic in which they live? My thought on that, I do talk about this for a few pages, but my main thought on that is, even if that's true, I don't know that that's such a big criticism, because that's really not what the book is about. You know, the book is about American history, not so much about why do Americans think about history the way they do. So there's that. But you've come up with an interpretation that sort of makes it make a bit more sense to me, sort of the idea that then what's the point of your project? Because you're saying Americans have lived through all of this. And I think my guess is Zen would say, well, the reason he's doing it is that one of the reasons why so many people have accepted it is that the events of history are presented to them under a certain framework that of legitimacy, you know. So, you know, giving an alternate narrative might have the effect of helping people to think about it in a different way. But then also, I guess the other thing I would say about this, and this isn't me, this is someone, I don't know him, someone named Stuart Easterling, but I found something that he had commented on this where he says, you know, Zen does talk about this a fair amount. I'll just quote Easterling because I quote him in my book. Easterling says this, Zen emphasizes a range of factors, including the effects of the ideology of the oppressor in the news media, for example, the use of violence and repression by the oppressor, forcing the oppressed to compete for scarce resources, the oppressor's control of the main available political alternatives, that is Democrats and Republicans, the oppressor's knack for dispersing their controls and giving the oppressed small rewards for maintaining the organizations and institutions that help perpetuate oppression. And he goes on, it's a little longer than that, but he says, you know, Zen does in fact talk about this. And then the one other thing I would add is, while it's true that a lot of working class people who have lived through some of this stuff nonetheless completely accept the sort of dominant historical narrative, part of what Zen's book shows is a whole lot of them don't. And the activities of those who don't have tended to be written out of history. So his book, as you know, is full of stuff about protest movements, labor strikes, that sort of thing, by people who are resisting. And this resistance tends to, you know, not get much play in traditional history textbooks. So just to give one example, this is one Zen talks about a lot in his autobiographical writings. He mentions how when he was both an undergraduate and a graduate student at Columbia University, you know, an Ivy League school and everything with a top-notch history department, he never learned anything about the Ludlow Massacre, this amazing event where there were strikers, you know, and they were just murdered by the federal government. And he learned about it from a Woody Guthrie song, you know, the Ballad of the Ludlow Massacre. So I think that's part of how Zinn would answer Kazin. It would be sort of a threefold answer. Number one, that's not the point of his book. Number two, he does address it to some extent. Number three, part of why people have accepted the dominant narrative is that's what they've been told, that's the framework they've had, and so part of the point of his book is to offer a different framework. Because, see, you brought up intellectual frameworks before. When atrocities happen, but you've got a kind of framework in mind. I'll give you a ridiculous sports analogy. I've noticed that I like baseball, and I've noticed that, like, if someone has a reputation as an excellent fielder, anytime he makes a bad fielding play, the announcer will say something like, "Wow, that's a real anomaly. He's a great glove man. You won't see that very often." Blah blah. So it's immediately contextualized as something to kind of dismiss as an anomaly, rather than just kind of played straight. And so that's, I think, part of what goes on with the standard historical narrative. The horrible atrocities are either left out or they're contextualized as maybe, you know, part of the price of progress, or it's even worse in other places, or this is something we're overcoming because we're so virtuous, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's some sort of, it's not just sort of presented straight. And so by Zinn giving you a different selection of events, I guess, and a little bit of a different framework for understanding it, that in itself might be a kind of intervention in, you know, how people might interpret the past.
So here's my final question.
Sure.
Is Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States still being taught in Indiana?
Oh, yes. Yes, it absolutely is. One of my colleagues right here at Purdue Northwest, as I mentioned, I'm not a history professor. I'm a philosophy professor. One of the historians here regularly teaches it. I know, and I mentioned in my book, this is another funny thing going back to the Mitch Daniels thing. When Mitch Daniels went on his little email rant to his subordinates, telling, you know, get rid of this book, ban it, and everything, well, nothing much happened as far as we can tell. It looks like it was kind of a one-day discussion. And so when it was made public, one of the explanations he gave was, well, we looked into it and we found that the book isn't being taught anywhere in Indiana. Well, I already knew that was false because I teach a course on critical thinking, a philosophy course, critical thinking, and one of the textbooks I use has a chapter about history, and it makes a very Zinn-like point about how in all nations, not just in America, history tends to be very much sanitized and presented in a way as to glorify, you know, the heads of state, et cetera, et cetera. And so I will ask my students, well, when you were taking history in high school, did you find that to be true? And always there would be three or four students who would say, well, no, because we used Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States. And then I would ask, well, did you go to a public school or a private school? And frequently it was a public school. My son, when he was in high school, he was a tennis player. And it was while I was writing the book. And so one time I was at one of his tennis matches and I was carrying a People's History. And the coach of the other team came over to him. He says, "Oh, I see you've got that book. I'm a history teacher. I use that book in my class." And this was another public school. And the final bit of evidence, there is on the web, there's a website called the Howard Zinn Education Project, I think is the name of it, something like that. And they provide materials to use, for teachers to use in conjunction with Zinn's book. And when this happened, they pointed out that there are like hundreds, I think it was either dozens or hundreds of teachers from Indiana have registered at that website. You know, so I think it's pretty clear it is still being used. I don't think it's by any means the most popular book to be used. And also my sense is it's not usually used exclusively. It's usually used in conjunction with a more conservative text, but it is still being used.
Right. So it would be, you would read an excerpt from Zinn's book alongside the actual main textbook, maybe?
Yeah, oftentimes it would be done that way. And then you can get into the whole question of, you know, why are they so different and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, listen, I think this is a really good interview. We've got plenty of material here. Is there any question that you wished I had asked that I didn't?
I don't know that there's any question that you have not asked, but can I just mention one thing on my mind about this whole project? And that is, I'm very eager to learn of any kind of response to this from the people I've criticized. A couple of them are dead. Oscar Handlin's dead. He's excused. He doesn't have to respond. But these people who are alive and kicking and famous, I just wonder if any of them are going to respond. And one reason I ask that, I've given 7 or 8 lectures on this topic at various colleges and universities around the Midwest. And that's always one of the first questions the audience will ask, because I'll present these devastating criticisms of these famous historians. I'll say, well, what are any of them saying about this? And I just want to share with you one person who's done a kind of non-response. And so this is Sam Weinberg of Stanford. And to just set this up, one thing that I find particularly interesting about him is his specialty, as I understand it, is not so much history per se as history education. And I gather he's maybe the leading figure in the country in the field of history education. And his rhetoric is always so elevated. It's always all about, oh, we have to be, you know, open-minded and evidentiary and open to changing our minds. And so his work on Zinn is very censorious, and it's probably the most incompetent work of anyone in the book. He wrote an 8-page essay, and it has like 30 demonstrable falsehoods in it. And just to give you one example, his essay is called Undue Certainty. So his main criticism of Zinn is he thinks Zinn is overly dogmatic. And so one of his pieces of evidence is he says, well, good historians are modest. They recognize how difficult it is to reconstruct the past from present evidence. So they're very halting and tentative in their rhetoric, and they use lots of qualifiers, you know, perhaps, maybe, possibly, that sort of thing, whereas Zinn does not. And so he then says, a search through a people's history for qualifiers mostly comes up empty. And in another place, he says, mostly comes up short. He extinguishes, that's his word, he extinguishes perhaps. And so Zinn's book is online, and you can do an in-text search. And so in my book, I quote how Zinn uses the word perhaps. Where is it now? He uses it 101 times, and I list all the pages in which he does. And Zinn uses seems, and seemed 130 times, and so on and so forth. So notice, you know, this guy who says you have to nail everything down with evidence, he says he's done a search and it comes up empty, but he doesn't tell us what the search is. I do the search and completely refute it. Okay, so anyway, getting to his response, and there are lots of other things like that. That's just one example. So he has a new book that came out around the same time as Xenophobia. And to publicize that book, he published an excerpt at the Slate.com website. And the thing he chose was his updated chapter on Zinn, which is based on the piece on Zinn that I'd criticized in my book. So I wrote a response to that, and posted it online. So now finally I get to the non-response. So someone named Mike Reynolds sent him a tweet on September 23rd, 2018, saying, "Hey, Sam Weinberg, I would love to hear you respond to David Dettmer. He seriously calls into question key aspects of your critique of Howard Zinn." So here's his reply, Weinberg. "The Slate piece is a short overview of a 12,000 chapter, I assume he means 12,000 word chapter, with pages and pages of documentation. Judging my argument by reading Slate is like judging a 2-hour movie from its preview." That's it. That's his response. And so in reply, anyone who would have looked at my article would see it's not about the Slate piece. It's only got one or two sentences on the Slate piece. It's mostly about this long article, you know, that he had published in a journal called The American Educator. He refers to his, quote, "pages and pages of documentation," but as I show in Xenophobia, many of his claims are presented without documentation or stand in opposition to the documents that are alleged to support them. The movie preview analogy is completely dubious because the purpose of a movie preview is to stimulate interest in seeing the entire film, but critical articles, even if they're shortened versions of a larger work, still have to be able to stand on their own. There's no license to misquote, state falsehoods, advance fallacious arguments, and so on. So it's just ridiculous. And so my sense is that these guys are just not going to respond. And, you know, what's David Greenberg going to say when he said, you know, Zinn seems to have stayed silent on the Soviet Union, and I've got all these, you know, all these quotes in books that he should know about, because he calls A People's History a lousy piece of work, and his article is a review of a biography of Zinn, and that review quotes some of these things too. So it's just incompetence, and I'm just kind of thinking it's important for the historical record to be corrected, but I think these guys are just not going to confront the evidence I've presented.
You know, it strikes me that we've been trying to get Ben Shapiro to debate one of our authors. I might as well just email every one of these critics and ask them if they want to come on. I'll try to get my equipment to work better than it did today. But we should try to get them all on and see if they'll confront you on the podcast.